Coming up on this episode of Crime Family.
At the end of the previous episode, we finished it off where the police found a torso in San Francisco Bay along with the body of a male fetus on the shoreline. And so we're going to go into more of that discovery, and that's where we're going to kind of pick it up. Out of all this stuff, like, that to me is the most sketchy. And while I'm sure there's probably a reasonable explanation, but it is a little bit like all those things.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to look at that as a whole and be like, oh, no, it's fine. It does kind of, yeah, definitely raise suspicion. Now, the prosecution did not have where the murder took place. They didn't have a how the murder happened, and they didn't even really have a when.
This case is ginormous. There's a lot to go over.
I don't understand what's happening, because it's like, normally prosecution is like really on it with all their information, and like, this just goes so sideways in like 30 seconds.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Crime Family. I'm your co-host, AJ, and I'm here with my sisters, Stephanie and Katie. And this is part three of our Lacey Peterson murder case coverage. Deep dive. We've covered in the first two parts a lot of information already. This case is ginormous. There's a lot to go over. So definitely, if you haven't checked out the first two parts, make sure you do that, because we really set up the case and Lacey's disappearance and talk a lot about the suspicion that was on Scott and how the police are kind of zeroing in on him and all of the evidence that they think they have. Obviously, we're going to continue that a little bit more in depth in this part as well. But yes, just make sure you're all kind of caught up. Go and check those two parts out. But because we have a lot to cover, we're just going to get right into it with part three. At the end of the previous episode, we finished it off where the police found a torso in San Francisco Bay along with the body of a male fetus on the shoreline. And so we're going to go into more of that discovery, and that's where we're going to kind of pick it up with this part. So in April 2003, a severely decomposed torso was found in San Francisco Bay, but the head and many parts of the limbs were not found with the torso. A male fetus was also found a mile away by a pair of passersby, and these two bodies that were found were determined to be disturbingly that of Lacey and of her and Scott's unborn son, Connor. I believe Connor's body was found first on April 13th, and then it was the next day on April 14th where they found Lacey's torso in the water. When the news first came out initially, ABC News reported that the umbilical cord was still attached, but then on May 30th, which would have been like a month and a half later, they actually changed that and then reported that the umbilical cord and placenta were not found with the body. So that had been some misreporting at the very beginning. So according to that ABC News report from May 30th of 2003, when they corrected the record, it says, quote, Lacey Peterson's head and parts of her limbs were missing and plastic tape was wrapped around the neck of her child, according to the full autopsy and coroner's photographs exclusively seen by ABC News. According to the autopsy, the skin of the child was not decomposed at all, though the right side of his body was mutilated, and the placenta and umbilical cord were not found with the body. So Lacey's torso was apparently so badly decomposed that it wasn't even easily recognizable as a human body. So part of the police's theory, again, they're zeroing in on Scott, they came to the conclusion that they believe that Scott had made these makeshift concrete anchors that he used to sink Lacey's body to the bottom of the bay. And there was actually a major thunderstorm in the area very shortly before the bodies ended up turning up. And police believe this is what caused Lacey and Connor's remains to kind of become dislodged from the anchor and then end up floating to the top of the water where it was eventually found. Police also say that Scott had told them in his story of the day Lacey went missing that he took his boat out of Berkeley Marina and straight to Brooks Island, where he saw a no landing sign. And this area that was described by Scott was actually ended up being very close to where the remains of Lacey and Connor were eventually discovered. So again, this is another detail that really makes him question Scott, because this area that he's describing way before the bodies are even found ends up being very relevant to where the bodies end up being discovered and nearby. Police were also alarmed by items that were found in Scott's car that looked as if he was living a nomadic life and indicated that he might be a flight risk. So around the time that these bodies were discovered, this is when they noticed or they come across these items in Scott's car. So a USA Today article writes, quote, "He was found in La Jolla, California, with his dark hair dyed blonde and his car filled with $15,000 in cash, 4 cell phones, 2 driver's licenses, one being his brother's, several changes of clothes, and survival camping gear. Because he was near the Mexico border, prosecutors accused him of planning to flee the country," end quote.
Yeah, so while this does seem sketchy, Scott's family and friends do have explanations for each one of these things. They say that Scott was headed to the Torrey Pines golf course, which was just 30 miles from the Mexican border, so he wasn't fleeing to Mexico, he was just happened to be close to the border. And so he had dyed his hair because he says he was fearful and wanted anonymity. And there was actual angry mobs outside the courthouse whenever he had to go in, and people were leaving threatening messages on its answering machines. And so because the public had convicted him and were really out to get him, he was scared for his life and he wanted to change his appearance to maybe escape from some of that. And Pat Harris, who was on Scott's defense team, said that there are pictures of Scott in disguise meeting with the lead detective, Steve Grogan. So it seems like he didn't have this disguise so he could try and hide from the police. He was trying to hide from the media because he was still meeting and talking to police while he had this quote-unquote disguise. They say that he had his brother's ID so that he could get a discount at the golf course he was going to. So, I mean, presumably his brother had a membership there. And if he used his brother's ID, then he could, you know, get a discount pretending to be his brother. Not a huge deal. And $15,000 in cash also had an explanation. So Scott's mother, Jackie, had accidentally taken out $10,000 from their joint checking account. And so she returned it to Scott in cash so that there wouldn't be a hold on it at the bank. And so that's kind of why he had all of this cash on him. Was just kind of like an accident from his mother. So it's not super unbelievable that kind of all these things together do look suspicious, but they do have explanations if you believe it.
But how do you accidentally take $10,000 out of some account?
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Yeah, well, I guess him and his mother have a joint account. Maybe she meant to take $10,000 out of her own personal account and just like use the wrong card or something.
Why would you need to take $10,000 out at once?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's sketchy in and of itself. Like, I don't know any regular person who would need to do that.
I don't know either, but I mean, it was his mother apparently taking it out for herself and took it out of the wrong account. I don't know, but that's just the explanation, though.
And were these, like, confirmed, like, I'm assuming, like, have these been confirmed details? Like, his mother is confirmed that, yes, it was her, and yes, his brother did have a membership at the golf course and, like, all that stuff?
Yeah, so the person that kind of put this explanation forward was, I believe it was Scott's sister Janie, or his sister-in-law Janie Peterson. So obviously she's biased towards Scott, but she's not just going to make stuff up, I feel.
I was just going to say, like, nothing against his family. Like, I kind of feel like they could be made up stories just to kind of explain those situations away. But
I mean, yeah, they definitely could have just made all that up to make it fit. But
and also, like, the unfortunate thing for them, too, is the police aren't going to corroborate that because they don't want to explain those things away. They want that question to be out there. So it's not like the police are even going to go and check into it. So you kind of have to just take their word for it. And I mean, all those things together, like, I mean, I mentioned in the previous parts, like, I do believe Scott's innocent. But like those things, it's like, what are the chances you would have all that stuff in your car and have like a perfect answer for everything? Like, that to me is a little bit suspicious.
I feel like it's not out of the realm of possibility that he was living in his car, because if he had like people outside his house 24/7, like watching his every move, wouldn't you want to get out of your house and kind of get away from the media. Like, maybe he wanted to live in this car to get just to hide from that.
Yeah, and he had, like, camping stuff, so maybe he just wanted to kind of, like, camp or just away from everything just to get away from people, which that makes sense.
And he was still talking to cops, too, right? So it's not like he was trying to hide from everybody.
Yeah, he was still in contact with his family, with the cops. Yeah, so, yeah, it's not like he was on the run. And I think it was that same person Janie brought up. If he was going to run, why wait around until they had discovered the bodies and, like, figured out the identities? Like, if he was going to run, why wouldn't he do that from the beginning kind of thing, right? So,
well, because maybe he didn't expect them to be found.
I guess, but she said once the bodies were found, that's when he could have run, not, like, wait around to see if they could figure out who they were. Right? You think you'd run right away, but I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that to me, even though I think he's innocent, as we'll get into more, that to me was one thing that was kind of like, out of all this stuff, like, that to me is the most sketchy. And while I'm sure there's probably a reasonable explanation, but it is a little bit like all those things.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to look at that as a whole and be like, oh, no, it's fine. It does kind of, yeah, definitely raise suspicion.
And I think a theme that comes up often too is people will say, like, if Scott's innocent, he's the most unlucky person in the world for all those things to have happened and be found in his car just by chance, even though they're all completely innocent.
Yeah, I know that's true. But also when it's like when you think of the other way, the police think Scott is guilty. So they're going to put all these different scenarios together to make it look like he's guilty. Then if you think he's innocent, then every scenario you're going to have an explanation for why he's innocent. So it could go both ways, right? They could just be like really grasping at straws to show that he's innocent too. So got to think about that as well.
Yeah, that's true. So on April 18th, 2003, so this would have been four or five days after the bodies were found in San Francisco Bay. And April 18th was the day that the forensic examiners confirmed the remains that were found were of Lacey and Connor. So it took them that 5-day period to do those tests and confirm those details. And on that same day, April 18th, Scott was arrested for their murders. So after nearly 4 months of suspicion by police, they finally had their suspect in custody and finally had enough evidence in order to arrest him. Because leading up to this, you know, they had nothing that was a smoking gun, nothing that they could even tie to him other than circumstantial evidence. So this was really the thing that pushed it over the edge. It's like, okay, we got him. We can bring him in now. And so they finally had him in custody after 4 months, and Scott Peterson was about to be put on trial for the murder of his wife and unborn son. But the question was, did they have the right person in custody?
Yeah, and that's like the huge question in this case, of course. And according to the public, you know, they had convicted Scott right from the beginning, and the prosecution right from the get-go said that the trial was going to be a slam dunk. But the defense, of course, was not going to roll over and accept that they didn't have a chance. And so when they looked deeper into the case in preparation for the trial, they discovered that the prosecution actually had a lot less solid evidence than they were acting like they did. So Scott's arraignment was held in April of 2003, and he was being charged with 2 counts of intentional premeditated murder, and he pled not guilty to both of those charges. And after consulting with Lacey's family, the DA actually decided that it was going to seek the death penalty in this case. And so picking the jury was not going to be an easy task. The trial was moved out of Modesto for obvious reasons, and it was moved to Redwood City in San Mateo County, which was only 50 minutes away from Modesto.
Yeah, and we've seen this in other cases before where it's really highly high profile. There they will move the trial, but I mean, 50 minutes isn't, you know, super far away. Like, it's not unreasonable that somebody 50 minutes away would not have any knowledge of the case when someone in Modesto would, which is weird, but...
Yeah, and someone even, I mentioned, I think it was Scott's defense attorney, said that they moved it closer to San Francisco, which was like a journalism hub and, you know, a media hub. So it was like kind of even closer to the action, which was unfortunate for Scott.
Again, the unluckiest guy in the world. After the trial was moved to Redwood City, Scott's attorney, Kirk McAllister, bowed out, and Scott's family then hired Greg Garagos, who was a high-profile attorney at the time, and they had seen him on The Larry King Show, always defending Scott against the panel of people that would also be on, that would be saying that he was guilty. So They thought that he would be a great fit, as he clearly didn't think that Scott was guilty.
And as reported in the A&E docuseries called The Murder of Lacey Peterson, about 50% of the people that filled out the jury questionnaire admitted that they already thought Scott was guilty, and they couldn't find many people who would even consider the thought that Scott was innocent. And so they really had a hard time finding people that would admit that they would give him a fair trial without bringing in all the prejudice that they had from the media's portrayal of him. And so the pool to choose jury members from was very small. And even from the people that they thought they could choose from, some were just acting as though they were open-minded and they just wanted to get on the jury so that they could convict him. And one woman who actually made it past the preliminary screening was actually called out by someone who she was talking to online. So this guy says that this woman was like trashing Scott online and she was laughing at the defense because she had tricked them and made her way through the screening. And so, of course, he reported her and she was dismissed. But that's just the kind of people that were just trying to get on there just so they could convict Scott.
It's very unlikely that he's going to be given a fair shake, especially considering the high media attention in this case. And it actually took 9 weeks to find the 12 jurors and the 6 alternates that they felt would be a good fit for this trial. Also, the jury wasn't sequestered. It was a month-long trial, so they were actually exposed to way more from the media than they should have been. Now, this was actually like strange to me. I didn't see this in my research, but yeah, they weren't sequestered is wild to me. Usually they would sequester the jury. That's like kind of a priority, usually.
I think it's because they knew it was going to be like a 5 or 6 month long trial. And when they figured out like the cost of the hotels, it was going to be for everyone to stay in a hotel for 6 months. The cost was too high. So they're like, no. So it all comes down to money always.
Well, I mean, wasn't the OJ trial like 9 months or something, and they were sequestered for that whole time?
So. Yeah, I know. So yeah, priorities, I don't know.
Yeah, so that's crazy to me that they're not sequestered, because how can you have a fair trial? All a juror has to do is turn on Nancy Grace for one night at any point during the trial and it's all over, in my opinion.
Yeah, really, Nancy Grace really had a lot to say in this case.
Yeah,
like I guess they were told they can't research stuff and look at the media, but it's like impossible. Like, just leave the courthouse and there's a huge mob that hates Scott, so it's super hard.
And I mean, granted, it is 2004. So, I mean, technology isn't what it is today. Obviously, there's still internet and there's still ways, you know, the news and stuff like that. But maybe not everyone.
Well, the tabloids everywhere.
Oh, yeah. True. So it's like, yeah, I mean, just sequester them, obviously. Doesn't matter if it's like 1961 or 2004 or whatever. Like,
it also kind of almost makes it worse because you look at the tabloids and then you don't have something like that you can research to rebut that, right? It's just the tabloids saying everything, and that's the only source that you have, really. So it made it a lot worse.
Yeah. And this is like back probably when the tabloids were much more widely read. Like, I think most people now know that like the tabloids are a joke. I mean, there's obviously still people who believe them, but back then I think it was even more so like people took whatever it said as the truth and didn't question it as much.
And I feel like they could write whatever they wanted in there back then. Because, like, I saw one while I was watching these documentaries where it was like, Scott had a gay lover. Like, why does that matter even if he did? And, like, who made that up? Like, it was just, it's just crazy. They could say whatever they wanted.
Yeah. It's so stupid.
One of the things that bothers me about media in general, like, even today, it's like these people are so adamant that he was guilty. Like, and, like, no matter what they saw or heard or, like, whoever defended him, like, the media from the get-go wanted him to be guilty. And that's what I struggle with media today, is that, like, nobody really takes in consideration of, like, the true facts. They just go with what everybody else is saying. So it's really hard, especially in this case, for, like, Scott to, like, have anybody behind him besides his family. I don't know, media annoys me. But we also wouldn't have crime shows and stuff today if it wasn't for media.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of bias in general, but I think it's like, one thing is you can have your own opinion, but you can't have your own fact, right? So like, you can present the facts. Like, if the media presents the fact, you can have different opinions on what the facts mean or interpret them, but like, it's still a fact, right? So that's where I think the difference is. And like, a lot of times, yeah, we do see bias in many forms of media, but especially back here in the tabloid days. I mean, that's not really bias, that's just straight up lying.
We all have all of our opinions, but if all the media is saying, like, he's guilty, he's guilty, he's guilty, then you're going to be like, oh, well, I guess he's guilty because you don't want to be that one person to think he's innocent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I'm going to touch on that a bit, too, when I talk about some of the jury. But it's also when you think of someone like Nancy Grace, who used to be a lawyer, and she's, like, this legal analyst, and I guess, you know, a lot of people trust her because she's, like, a professional in the law. And when she's just, like, saying all these random things, and she's convicted Scott as well, people just, you know, are going to hop on board with that just because of who she is, sort of. So, and, like, people even called her out, like, on the air. Like, Nancy Grace, do you think it's fair that you're, like, convicting Scott when you don't even have the facts? So, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, there's whole videos of compilations of people trolling Nancy Grace, like, when they go on her show. I love those videos.
I don't know, people put her on such a, like, a pedestal, and I feel like she's, like, the queen of crime for a lot of people.
Oh my god, back in the day, though, I used to love watching Nancy Grace before I realized
me too.
She kind of just said whatever. Like, I don't hate Nancy Grace, but I'm just saying, like, it's entertaining, but yeah, you can't take what she says as fact.
Yeah, I mean, she had her job that long on that show because of the entertainment factor, right? Like, at a certain point, people didn't necessarily care what was coming out of her mouth, even if they should have. It's like, it's entertaining. It's, like, fun to watch people go troll her or, like...
But that should not be allowed either, though. Like, put fake information out there that you don't even know that's true. We can't say that on our podcast. Like,
we can say, this is my opinion.
Yeah, or allegedly.
That's what she said. She's like, oh, last time I checked, this is the United States and it's just free speech. Like, these are all my opinions going off by what I know. And so, I mean, she was defending herself, but...
Yeah, she doesn't preface it with that always. She's just like...
Mm-hmm.
And also she'll, like, bring up debunked theories and, like, talk about them as if they're true. You have to understand that, like, I feel like a majority of people who are going to watch her show are not going to do any outside research. They're just going to take what she's saying. They trust her, so they're going to take what she's saying as truth. So obviously you can go and research it yourself. You have to know that the majority of people aren't doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So Scott's trial started June 1st, 2004. Rick DiStasto was the lead prosecutor, and he led with the opening statements. During the opening statements, the prosecutor said he was going to prove that Scott killed his wife because he was having an affair with Amber Fry and that his behavior before and after the death of his wife just didn't seem right. Especially after his wife was dead, he didn't show any real emotion, so all stuff we've covered previously. He seemed cold and not how you would expect someone to act if they had just found out that their wife and child was dead. And even when Lacey was still a missing person, his behavior was the same. So DiStasto was really focused on how Scott was acting during the whole investigation. Because there was no solid evidence inside the Peterson home that linked Scott to Lacey's death, but there were some inconsistencies with Scott's story that the prosecutor was trying to extract from the case.
And so the prosecution's theory was that Scott had killed Lacey on December 23rd and then spent that night cleaning up the scene, making the house look normal. And then in the morning of the 24th, they say that's when he loaded her up into his truck and dumped her in the bay while he was out on his boat. And in this case, the prosecution did not have any solid evidence for cause of death or even have evidence of where the crime scene was. All they thought they had was when the crime occurred and a possible motive. And so they only had circumstantial evidence in this case, and they used that to play on the emotions of the jury.
Since the prosecution had very little evidence against Scott and nothing linking him to Lacey's death, they wanted to focus on his behavior and suggested that Scott had several motives of why he would kill his wife. One of those motives was that they believe that Scott was done with his marriage, he just wanted out, and he felt too much pressure becoming a father and didn't really want that relationship. And he wanted to continue his relationship with Amber, who, remember, he had only met like literally a month before Lacey was killed, or at least before Lacey went missing. So they suggest that he was also in a lot of financial troubles and he didn't want to have that burden weighing him down. So for me, I have trouble with this situation because any sane person who wanted out of a relationship would just sit down and ask for a divorce, seek financial support. But my first thought would not be to kill someone, which then again, I mean, you can really see the kind of person Scott really was. And I also feel bad for Amber because she just was so naive to all of this at first. So I mean, they're really trying to paint Scott as this villain, trying to sell to the jury as much as they can that he just was, you know, a adulterer who just didn't love Lacey anymore and just wanted to get rid of her as quickly as he could. So I guess they say that that justifies or that is enough reasoning to just say that he murdered her without any real solid evidence besides circumstantial. So Sharon Rocha, which is Lacey's mother, she testified that when she was at Scott and Lacey's house, a lot of people were gathered around looking for Lacey. And there was one point where she wanted to give Scott a hug, but he always kept at a distance and wouldn't meet her eyes, like wouldn't give her eye contact, which she thought was weird. Another time when they were in the park, she was calling out to him, trying to get his attention, but he wouldn't acknowledge her at all. So this awkward gesture suggests that maybe he didn't want anyone to know he was at the park, and his language was a bit off and kind of standoffish. So I guess that's her position. And by this time, obviously, she's totally convinced that he's guilty. And even in the AABC 2020 documentary that I watched, she does tell a story how shortly before Lacey went missing, she was very pregnant by this point. It was her, Scott, and Lacey just hanging out at Lacey's house, and the baby was kicking. And so Lacey was very excited, and like her mother, of course, touched her stomach, but then Scott would not touch her stomach and didn't seem interested or didn't seem excited or anything like that. So she also thought that was really weird. So that's also something that's in her mind, and she's totally convinced that he's guilty by this point.
It doesn't seem like an off thing for him not to do. Like, I don't know if that's just me.
I think like, And I don't think, obviously, at the time when it happened, it wasn't a red flag because this was before she went missing. But then it was maybe in retrospect, like thinking on it, she's like, oh, that's kind of weird. She probably had to like go back in her mind and be like, did I see the signs? Like, did I miss anything? And that probably came to her mind because she's telling this story in 2020. And maybe it wasn't the fact that he didn't, but maybe the fact that he was just didn't seem excited or didn't seem like he really cared. That was alarming.
Well, it would also make sense if he didn't care, like if he was trying to get out of his marriage, if he didn't like want to be there.
Yeah, just like emotionally detached kind of, and that's how he showed it. He obviously wasn't that excited.
Also, memories can change based on what your opinions are, right? Like by this time when she starts thinking he's guilty, maybe that can change your memory in some way. So every memory of him seems a little bit more sinister than it actually was. So maybe when she goes back to remember it, it's more of like a weird, alarming thing than it actually was.
Because we already know, like, he was a very unemotional person anyways. That's how his demeanor was, even growing up, according to his mother. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that he just didn't show emotion towards the child, or Lacey, for that matter.
Yeah, and we don't know how he acted with just him and Lacey in private, right? Maybe he wasn't, like, feeling her up in front of her family and stuff. Like, maybe they did that when there was nobody else there, right? So we don't know. And yeah, and so kind of some of this behavior to me, it kind of seems like that's maybe where Scott's head was at when he was talking to Amber about this being his first Christmas without his wife. He might have been thinking that, like we were saying, he emotionally just wasn't there, and he may have been planning to, or he might have even told Lacey that he wanted out of their marriage, even though he does admit later that he still loved Lacey and that his affair with Amber was, you know, just kind of like a selfish thing. It wasn't because he didn't love Lacey. But, I mean, you don't really know exactly where his head was at. He did say in an interview before that he had told Lacey about Amber weeks before Lacey had disappeared. So maybe he was working on an exit from his marriage, or maybe he was at least thinking about it, even if he was still in love with her. So probably just a lot of confusing emotions happening. The prosecution spent a lot of time showing that Scott was a liar and a cheater and really getting the jury to dislike him. One of the examples that Rick DeStasso brought up was the fact that Scott had lied about his mourning with Lacey on December 24th. So like I said in the first episode, Scott mentions that they were watching the Martha Stewart show and they were talking about meringue or what to do with meringue in the show that morning. And they feel that they have outed him in a lie about his alibi, because he says they were talking about meringue in that episode, but then the prosecution actually says that they didn't mention it in that show that morning at all. So they are feeling like they maybe have outed him about his alibi. But on the second day of trial, which was June 2nd, the defense made their opening statements, and they played into the point that the prosecution was trying to make by saying that, oh, you may not like Scott Peterson, he may have lied about some things like hiding his affair, but that doesn't mean he's a killer. And Mark Garagos brings up that Martha Stewart episode again, and he actually plays the episode that was aired that morning, and there actually is a little snippet about making the egg whites into meringue. And so this is a little detail, but it was used as such like a huge blow to the prosecution, because I guess they didn't even bother to watch the whole episode, and they're just trying to use this to paint Scott as a liar, even about the littlest things in his alibi. But I mean, if you're going to make a bold claim like that, then I think you would at least back it up by watching that full episode.
Sorry, I'm just laughing. I'm just laughing because, like, why would they... Who cares about what Martha Stewart was doing in that episode?
I know. I think they were just trying to prove... Prosecution was trying to be like, well, no, you didn't sit there that morning and watch Martha Stewart because you don't know what happened in the episode.
But he might have not even been sitting there. He could have been, like, in the kitchen or something, like, listening to it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like...
Yeah, but he was saying that they said a specific topic and they were trying to prove that that wasn't that episode. Which is, like, relevant because if that was a different day, like, it messes up the timeline.
True, it does. And I was just thinking, like, if I was a prosecution, like, I wouldn't want to put my whole case on that one episode. And plus, they didn't, like, case it. They didn't even, like, watch the whole thing. So it's just, like, a grasping at straws type thing.
I know. It feels like such a little detail to hone in on. But anyway, they thought they got him in that lie, which they didn't. So, it's, yeah, it's kind of funny. And the defense also brought up the fact that the police had seized over 100 bags of evidence from Scott's warehouse and the Peterson home to meticulously scour for evidence of the murder. And Garagos holds up a giant stack of lab results in court, and he says that investigators found absolutely nothing linking Scott to Lacey's murder. So he's saying there's absolutely no forensic evidence to suggest that Scott had harmed or done anything to Lacey in his warehouse or in his house. So June 3rd was the first full day of witness testimony, and one thing that was brought up in the media as the trial was going on was that even witnesses for the prosecution, when cross-examined, almost always gave something to the defense that was useful for them. So one of the prosecution witnesses was a computer analyst who looked at the computer in the Peterson's house, and he discovered that the morning of the 24th at around 8:40 a.m., someone was on that computer searching for a sunflower umbrella stand and looking at women's clothing. And so Lacey was known to have a love for sunflowers. She even had a sunflower tattoo. But this directly contradicts the prosecution's own timeline of Scott having killed her on December 23rd. If you believe that it was Lacey looking up those things on the computer that morning. And the defense says that this shortens the timeline, saying that Scott would have had to have killed Lacey, cleaned up the scene, got her in his truck all between 8:40 and 9:30 that morning. So to me, it's like a huge piece of evidence that the prosecution didn't really mean to bring forward, but they kind of did talking to that computer analyst. Because was Scott on the computer that morning looking up sunflower umbrella stands and women's clothing? It seems likely that he was not. The prosecution then fires back and says it was Scott making those searches to make it look like Lacey was still alive that time in the morning. And they claim this was all part of his big master plan. But then eventually, by the time that testimony was over, the prosecution had actually changed their entire theory and said, well, maybe the original timeline was wrong and Lacey was murdered that morning instead. So now the prosecution did not have where the murder took place. They didn't have a how the murder happened. And they didn't even really have a when for the murder. So it's not looking good for the prosecution so far.
Like, this just goes so sideways in like 30 seconds. They obviously didn't do their research enough.
I know.
I don't understand what's happening because it's like normally prosecution is like really on it with all their information and trying to like get all the right stuff. But this one just seems like they rushed into it or they just didn't look hard enough at evidence. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's just the defense team was just so good and they were just able to really drill into these witnesses that they really extracted a lot of things that the prosecution wasn't expecting or even knew about. So it's interesting.
And I think the prosecution probably went into it a little bit cocky. They probably thought, oh, it's a slam dunk, like we said before. Like they probably weren't, you know, the defense had to be much more careful with their details because everything was stacked against them. Whereas the prosecution, like if you think the jury is going to be tainted and against Scott, like they don't have to do much work. People are convincing themselves, right? Already before the trial even starts. So
yeah, they probably did think it was going to be way easier than it was because they're like, they're pretty much on our side anyway. We just have to go through the motions. Mm-hmm. But the defense was like not backing down.
Yeah. And I feel like their answer for everything is like, they're just trying to make, oh, Scott is like the smartest guy. Like, oh, he thought of all of these things. He thought to look on the computer for sunflower umbrellas just to make it look like it was Lacey. Like they were really kind of stretching it to say like, oh, Scott was there and he was doing all of these small And like even with leaving the voicemail for Lacey, like the day that she went missing, oh, because that's going to look good. If you really think Scott was that smart to be planting those seeds, I mean, it's not impossible, but.
But yeah, all those little details, it doesn't seem likely that he would, but.
Yeah. Like someone who has that much forethought and care of thinks about it that much is the same person going to have all the stuff in his car that looks super sketchy. Both things can't be true. Like if he's that sloppy.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. But so the defense argued that the police rushed to judgment when they didn't have all the facts or evidence and that the prosecution lacked forensic evidence, which was true. They argued that the police botched the investigation and Detective Dodge Hendy was on the stand for 4 days. And he admitted that even though they had extensively searched for evidence, they had found nothing that incriminated Scott. There were rumors in the media of evidence that had leaked out, such as the smell of bleach in the Peterson home, that there was vomit that had been cleaned up by the pool, but none of that was true. So the media had grabbed onto false evidence and hated Scott for things they thought were true. So just a lot stacked against Scott.
Yeah. And as AJ had mentioned earlier, the prosecution tried to point to cement anchors that they believed Scott had used to weigh down Lacey's body in the bay. And when they looked in Scott's warehouse, they could see a spot where it looked like an anchor had been made. And Scott admitted that, yes, he had made an anchor for his boat out of dry concrete that came out of a bag. And the prosecution said that it looked like he had made 4 more anchors in the warehouse as well. When asked what he did with the rest of the concrete in that bag, because there was a lot missing, which a lot more than would have been needed for just making one anchor, he said that he used it in his driveway to dry up some of the mud because it was really muddy. And so while the trial was happening, there were no cameras allowed in the courtroom at all. And so there was reporters that were kind of telling the media the play-by-play as things were happening. And they were just updating the media as the trial progressed. And Richard Cole, who was a journalist, he even went over to Scott's house with Nancy Grace, because Nancy Grace was trashing Scott daily on every show she could get on. And so they both went out to Scott's house. Nancy Grace could not believe that Scott would have used that leftover cement to fix his driveway. And when they go to his house, they actually clearly saw that there was cement chunks that were dried cement that had been mixed in with the mud near Scott's driveway. And so when Richard calls Nancy over and shows her, she saw them and she's just like, oh. But she never brought that up again. Like, she never mentioned it on air that she was, like, wrong about this particular piece. So she just never talked about it again. So very clearly, much of the media was only representing one side of the case. Richard Cole also said that from the pictures they showed of where the other anchors had allegedly been made, like, you could not tell that 4 more anchors had been made. It was just investigators trying to create evidence that wasn't necessarily there. And according to a report by People magazine, the defense presented an engineer and concrete expert who said that the concrete in Scott's driveway did match with what was in the bag that he had used to make that one anchor. So Scott was likely telling the truth that he made one concrete anchor, used a bunch of the leftover concrete to fix his driveway, and not 4 other anchors. Further, as Richard points out, that while testifying, an officer claimed that the fact that Scott had a receipt for the marina that day and was able to present it, this officer said that that was really suspicious, that he had kept this receipt and gave it to police. But Scott also claimed that he had stopped for gas on the way back from the marina, and when the officers asked if he had a receipt for that, Scott said no, he didn't get a receipt, and so the officers were saying, well, that's really suspicious, too. So it seems clear that really no matter what Scott did, he would have been seen as suspicious, because like, why would having one receipt be suspicious and then not having another receipt still be suspicious? And so Detective Owens was reported to have said that they had leads that were pointing them in other directions, but it wasn't taking them in the right direction. So to me, like, I'm just speculating, but it sounds like the other leads were not pointing to Scott. And so that wasn't the right direction that they wanted to go. And so they just discontinued with those leads. So like we said, very much tunnel vision on Scott and weren't even going to like consider following any other evidence or any other leads.
Can we go back to the receipt thing for a second?
Yes.
So maybe like at the marina, you have to pay for every time you dock your boat or whatever. So maybe he has a receipt. So the next time he's there, he doesn't have to pay again. But with the gas receipt, you just throw away because you have to pay for gas every time you get gas.
Maybe, but also, Yeah. But also what it makes me think is like some things like parking, if you're parking in like a parking thing, a receipt automatically gets printed out whether you want it to or not. You always have a receipt. Go to the gas station, you have an option for a receipt or not. So one of them, he got a receipt because that's just default. The second time, he said, no, he doesn't want a receipt.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And that's why he didn't have one.
Yeah.
He wasn't like planning everything and I want a receipt for everything. He's just, that's just how it went. And so why are both those things suspicious? It's just kind of crazy.
Yeah. And they also have to stick to one story, like either say that having receipts is suspicious or not having them is, but don't say it is suspicious when he doesn't. And then, oh, it's also suspicious when he does. Like you can't, both can't be true.
I know. Everything he does is suspicious regardless. So yeah, it's just, that's just one example of how much they just will focus on Scott again. So suspicion regarding Detective Brocchini. So he was the first investigator on the scene after the 911 call came in. Suspicions regarding him were brought up during the trial as well. So he was known as a guy who could always find evidence. And once he had his sights on someone, there was no turning back. And Brocchini even testifies that he was planting seeds of suspicion throughout this investigation. It was reported that Brocchini even went as far as falsifying police reports to keep the suspicion on Scott. So, as AJ mentioned in one of the previous episodes, the prosecution brought forward the fact that Lacey and her family didn't even know that Scott had a boat, but that proved to be incorrect because when cross-examined, Brocchini admitted that he had omitted in his police report facts that could have helped Scott. So Brocchini wanted people to believe that Lacey didn't know Scott had bought a boat, but in fact, someone who had a warehouse that was right across from Scott's actually told police that Lacey had been out to the warehouse to see the boat the day before she went missing, and Brocchini had intentionally removed that information from his report to make it look like the facts followed his narrative. So not only had he lied, he was also withholding evidence, basically. And on week 11 of the trial, so this is now August 10th of 2004, Amber Fry is called as a witness for the prosecution. And this is where the case really turns from being a disaster for the prosecution to potentially for them to have a chance at winning. So many of the jurors actually recall that just the tapes they played of Amber and Scott's conversations were kind of enough to turn some people's opinions. It was the recording of Scott at the vigil pretending that he was traveling abroad that really made people think he was guilty. So the trial is just chugging along, and the defense wants to address the fact that the prosecution thinks that Scott killed Lacey, loaded her into his boat with 4 or 5 8-pound anchors attached to her limbs, and throws her overboard while out in the bay. And Mark Garagos even goes and he buys the exact same boat. He gets someone to try and reenact the scenario in the bay with 100-pound body-like weight with the anchors. And he tapes this whole thing because he wants to see what if it's possible to even do that. And the person in this demonstration could not get this body and weight over the side of the boat without it tipping, capsizing, almost sinking. And there was also no scratches or dents on Scott's boat, which they say would have been very hard to accomplish with all these weights in the boat with him. And so basically the defense concluded that it was impossible to do this, but the judge decided to exclude this demonstration and explanation from the trial, just because I guess it just wasn't solid enough or, you know, too much speculation. I'm not sure of the reasoning, but they just decided that they shouldn't have this in the trial. Except, like, I mean, they wouldn't accept that, but then the prosecution brought in dog tracking evidence, and they have this dog handler testify that the dog was able to track Lacey's scent all the way down the ramp to the marina, which they said proved that Lacey had been there. But the defense quickly rebutted that, saying that the dog had failed its 2 prior certification tests, and they even had a tape of the dog going the wrong direction during one of these certification tests. And also the item that they had used to get Lacey's scent familiar to the dog for it to track, this was also an item that Scott had touched as well. So even if the dog was tracking correctly, it could have just been actually following Scott's scent and not Lacey's. And additionally, when a different dog was used to try and recreate this path, it could not find any evidence of a crime scene. It seems kind of crazy that this dog handler would be able to testify when really shouldn't even have a dog that was certified to do that. And the judge allowed that.
In most trials, dog tracking sense is not admissible in court, is it? Like, are you allowed to use that as evidence?
I mean, I think sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Like, I've definitely heard of trials where the dog tracking evidence is in there, a cadaver dog kind of thing.
Yeah. Wasn't the Casey Anthony case.
Yeah, it was in there, yeah. But a lot of people just say, well, it's junk science. Like, it's not actually true. Some people don't believe it at all. Some people just think you can kind of manipulate it to do what you want. But then this dog wasn't even certified. Like, it didn't even pass the test, and yet they were still letting the evidence it had found go into court. So, like, what the hell?
Just seems like a lot of back and forth. I just say random evidence, but just evidence that doesn't really prove anything, for one.
No, like, it proves one thing, and then the other side just proves against it, which is in every trial. But I think, like, you can use dog tracking evidence if you want to, but you probably shouldn't be putting all of your eggs in that basket. Like, you should really have something else more strong to back it up if you're going to use cadaver dog evidence, I think.
Yeah. Have a dog that's, like, fully trained. And
yeah,
maybe have, like, more than one dog be able to recreate that same path. I don't know. And don't use, like, an object that has more than one person's scent on it. You'd think would make sense, but anyway.
Just do the bare minimum, like, do the common sense thing.
Yeah, at least, but not in this case. So the defense had also planned to bring in some of the witnesses who claimed to have seen Lacey walking her dog on December 24th, but due to conflicting timelines, they decided that it was just too risky. So if you remember from the earlier episodes, we talked about the timeline with Lacey walking her dog. One witness, Karen Service, said she had put the dog back in the yard around 10:18 a.m., but then another witness says they saw Lacey walking the dog around 10:45. So they felt that somebody was mistaken either on who they saw or what time they saw it. And since they couldn't get a clear timeline, the defense decided to skip all those witnesses together just so that it didn't pick up during cross-examination. So they decided to keep those witnesses out. And the defense had brought in a doctor to testify about the state of Lacey and Connor's bodies. And as we mentioned, it was only Lacey's torso that was found. And so the prosecution said that if she was weighed down at her limbs and neck, then it kind of made sense that only her torso floated up as it separated from being pulled apart by the tides and wildlife. But the defense witness said that that's not how that usually happens. They testified that even bodies that have been submerged for years don't have limbs missing because fish and other wildlife don't typically chew through bone and cartilage to detach limbs, so it just didn't add up. And they also testified that Connor's time of death was sometime on or around December 29th or later. So if that was the case, then Connor was alive for days after they had gone missing, and it wasn't Scott who had killed them. But this witness, who was a doctor, he melted down on the stand during cross-examination. His credentials were questioned, his credibility was attacked, and he just couldn't take the pressure. And so the jury kind of disregarded everything he had to say, and they didn't put too much weight into his testimony because he kind of got frazzled. And also, the prosecution's witness did not agree with the December 29th timeline for Connor's death, so this was not a successful argument for the defense overall. So one of the most compelling arguments that the prosecution had going for them was the fact that Lacey and Connor were found in the bay where Scott had claimed to have gone fishing. And many in the media could not get over that this could have just been a coincidence, and they felt that it was enough to say that he was guilty. And one thing I want to mention before we actually get into the verdict and how all of this ended up is that there was a juror who was dismissed after 3 weeks because they were apparently discussing the case or trying to discuss the case with other jurors outside of the deliberation room. He said that when they would go out for lunch, sometimes the conversation would kind of steer towards the trial because, I mean, how could it not? That's what they're all there for. But then they would correct themselves and they would kind of stop talking about it. Everyone kind of did it. It wasn't just him. And it was a natural thing to do. He also had made a little comment to Lacey's brother one time while everyone was passing through the security check in the lobby of the courtroom. Since everyone was just kind of in there at the same time and they saw each other. And like, he even talked to a lawyer or somebody, a judge. He's like, when we see the family in the lobby and we're all going through security, like, what are we supposed to do? And like, they said, oh, you can say hi and acknowledge them, you know, but just like, don't talk about the case. And he had just said something like about the camera or the media that day. And one of the other jurors wrote to the judge about this. And then juror number 5 named Justin Faulkner was actually dismissed from the jury because of this. And after he was dismissed, he did a ton of interviews with the press. And he was saying that the prosecution was actually doing a really bad job, that there wasn't any evidence against Scott. And he was even arguing with Nancy Grace on the Larry King show. And he told her that everything she was saying was incorrect. And he even said that if he had to vote right then, he would vote not guilty for Scott. And because of this, because of that opinion that he had, he was getting death threats. People were emailing him, calling him an uneducated loser, a white trash loser. They said he deserved to die. And people even came to his house and destroyed his car. And so he said the other jurors knew all about this. And it was most likely in their head while they were making their decision. Like, knowing that most of the public thought that Scott was guilty, it had to sway their opinion or thoughts at least a little bit.
This is why you sequester jurors. A specific reason. So they can't talk to the family, or they can't talk to the media or whatever.
I mean, it was his decision to do all those interviews, but this is kind of maybe one of those things like they did in the Casey Anthony case, like don't release the names of the jurors. But he probably didn't expect that huge backlash either. Yeah, it's just kind of crazy. So November 3rd, 2004 was the first day of the jury deliberations. After 5 months, it was finally time for a decision. And in the beginning, the jury was actually split 10-2 for guilty. So there was only 2 people that wanted to vote not guilty. But, you know, 2 is better than nothing. And after 5 days, the jury wrote a letter to the judge telling him that one of the jurors had gone against the orders and actually looked into something on the internet that they had heard and they wanted to confirm. So that juror was actually dismissed and replaced with one of the alternates. And the original foreman of the jury, his name was Gregory Jackson. He was a very meticulous guy and he had taken a lot of notes. And he was actually leaning towards innocent as well for Scott. But he wanted to kind of go over everything logically and talk everything through. And a lot of the other jurors were saying that he was just being redundant and he wanted to kind of go over the same thing over and over again. And they were getting really tired of it and impatient. And some of the other jurors were getting hostile. They were yelling and threatening him. And he was scared and actually went to the judge, and he was dismissed off the jury as well. So this was the second one in 2 days to be dismissed. He was actually very much going to push for innocent, but he got bullied and kicked off. And later, one of the jury members said that if Greg had stayed on the jury, it probably would have been a hung jury because he was sticking to the facts and evidence and he was very strong-willed about that. And on November 12th, a verdict had finally been reached and Scott was found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder and he was actually sentenced to death. When the verdict was read, the crowd outside the courthouse erupted with cheers. And when Scott's family was leaving the courthouse, the crowd was yelling at them and berating them, yelling that Scott was a murderer. So this is just a super crazy reaction and super unnecessary, especially at Scott's family. Like, there's no need for them to be, like, harassing them. So you can just kind of see, like, this whole mob just cheering that Scott was found guilty. So yeah, after all that, that's the outcome of the trial. Scott's guilty, sentenced to death. Scott actually put an appeal in 2012. Luckily for Scott, in August 2020, his death sentence was overturned. And in December 2021, he was resentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So, you know, still not the outcome that obviously he would want, better than the death penalty. And that is, I think, is where we're going to wrap it up for this episode. We still have a ton more to talk about. But like we mentioned, we feel as though Scott is innocent and it had nothing to do with the disappearance and the murder of Lacey and Connor. And in the next episode, you'll see why we kind of think that. And we'll get into some of the things that were brought up regarding new evidence and things that cast doubt on the prosecution's theories. So join us next time for sure.
Yeah.
There's just so much in this case that it's...
I know. And even like the amount of stuff we've covered already, like there's probably, you know, there's thousands of pages of court documents. So we've only covered like probably 1% or 2% of what's actually out there.
Like if we did all of it, it would probably be like 8 or 10 episodes of just this case.
Probably more.
Oh my god, it would be like 5 months. Like the trial was 5 months.
Like we could probably do an episode about each day of the trial.
Oh yeah, we definitely could. And like we're just picking out the major things that are kind of out there in the media and on other sources. But I feel like, oh, I don't want to include everything. But then I feel like I do want to try to get the point across. But yeah, so it's a lot of stuff.
It's just so crazy how like so many jurors were dismissed and they had to find other people. And like if those jurors would have stayed, like I feel like it would have been a totally different outcome, which is not what they wanted. It was kind of like, well, you said earlier, they were bullying him, basically, the one juror to get out to be dismissed. It's like this whole mob mentality thing. For the media and jurors, it's just, like, unreal.
I know. It's crazy how it happened. And, yeah, like, Scott's super unlucky, I guess. Like, the one guy that was really going to root for him got kicked off or got bullied off the jury. So, I mean, yeah, crazy.
So he's, like, the unluckiest person in the world. And, yeah, I mean, that's the reason you sequester a jury. Like, there's a reason for that. That's not just a random procedure that's just implemented. Like, there's reasons for that because you said that other juror who went online and looked up stuff to confirm, like, you have to secure the jury. You have to have them sequestered for reasons like that. So it should have been like a mistrial just because, A, they didn't sequester the jury and all of the ways the jury could interact with the outside world, read the media, stuff like that. So it should have been a mistrial or a hung jury. But for Scott, who's like I said, one of the unluckiest guys ever, it wasn't like that at all. So that does it for this episode. We're going to wrap it up here. And then, like Katie said, next episode, we're going to continue our discussion, go back and forth on the theories and some of the new evidence that's come out recently. So you can catch us on all the social medias, Crime Family Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, Crime Family Pod 1 on X. You can become a patron for the show if you want early access to our episodes. Like, you can listen to next week's episode right now if you subscribe to our Patreon and become a paid member. You can listen to that. You get some bonus episodes and always get ad-free content. And the link to that's in the show notes. You can also get some merch from the show through our Redbubble store. The link is in the show notes to that as well. And always interact with us. Send us emails, crimefamilypodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts and theories and opinions on the show. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week with the final part of the Lacey Peterson murder case. Thanks so much. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.